Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Welcome to Adventures in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here today with Mac Burns with the Clatsop County Historical Society. Good evening, Mac.
You know, every now and then, you when your voice comes across, because as we're recording this, I'm wearing headphones, and I just think, wow, she sounds so professional as like compared to me.
Like I've done it before.
Like you've done it before, like maybe you have a degree in it or something.
But you do have the voice for radio. You do.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah. The face for radio.
I have the face.
There we go.
Definitely have the face for radio.
The face for radio.
And I'm still like in this COVID caveman.
I do.
I just don't know where I'm going yet with the whole facial hair.
You're rocking it as long as Renee is okay with it.
And
we're
she
all
is, apparently,
okay with so. It. Yes.
Well, I don't know that we're all okay with it. So before, unless there's other business,
no.
I have a new segment I haven't warned you about.
Okay.
I'm not sure the name of it yet. It might be just Rants by Mac. It might be What's Wrong with People. It might be, since we're just a few weeks removed, it might be Rant-a-Claus. And I'm bringing my bag of rants. I don't know yet. I haven't decided. I'm on the Riverwalk yesterday. We're walking along, and I like the Riverwalk. I'm not a dog hater, so don't even bother trying to write me that I hate dogs or something. I like dogs. I don't own a dog currently. I have. There are not one, not two, but three bags of dog poop. You've taken the time to bag your dog's poop. Why are you leaving it now?
I don't know. But yes, I hear your pleas. And unfortunately, I've heard them about other scenic areas in our community having that problem as well.
With as much rain, I would rather just leave the dog poop there at that point.
Ugh,
and it can wash.
That.
I mean, I'm not excited either way. But if I have to choose between one or the other, don't bag it, make it last longer.
I think that in the end, there is a good Samaritan out there, obviously not yourself, who will pick it up at one point.
And I felt badly because I did not pick up any of them.
Well, those extra pair of gloves you have around, you know?
So not only am I ranting about you bagged it and left it, but now you're making me feel badly that I didn't pick it up.
Sorry about that. You brought it up, and I brought up the solution.
You did. You pointed it out. Yep. And I dare say I was walking with my family, and there might have been a mention of you could pick it up.
Yeah. There you go.
So
same thing happens with my husband, you know. Tells me the problem, and I tell him the solution all the time.
That's what I always say to my teenage son is solutions. Yes. Let's look at solutions, not just the problem.
There we go.
All right. Shall we get to the big history highlights?
Let's go.
Because we have a good show today.
We do. Best one yet.
It is going to be the best show ever. Okay. So these are the history highlights of tomorrow.
Correct.
So you can go to work or Zoom meetings and feel really smart. 1759, Scottish poet Robert Burns is born. Somewhere I'm related.
Oh.
I'm not quite sure where.
Okay.
But I'm not one of these people that, you know, third cousin twice removed and then by marriage this and that and the other thing.
You just know.
Kind of direct line. And other than that, I don't really care. I'm not direct line. 1863, General Joseph Hooker replaces Burnside as the head of the Army of the Potomac.
Oh.
Poor Lincoln. He just like keeps having to fire generals and try and find ones that'll actually work. And of course, both of those guys are known because Hooker, that is in fact where the term hooker comes from.
Oh, wow.
Because he liked to have a lot of women around him.
Okay.
And he was General Hooker, and that's where the term actually comes from. And then Burnside, he actually had giant sideburns.
Oh.
And that too is where sideburns comes from, General Burnside.
Those are fun little facts of the day.
Let's see, 1905, the world's largest diamond is found. Are you into jewelry?
Not really.
See, I'm not either. I don't understand quite the appeal of
have
a big giant diamond ring or
especially
giant
if it costs
rings.
A lot. Because I have a lot of other things that could be purchased.
And they really don't retain their value.
Oh.
You know, it's something that your grandkids are gonna try and sell at the pawn store.
sentimental value.
For half the value.
Right.
Okay. I thought there was only going to be one rant today. Who knew? 1924, the first Winter Olympics are held in the French Alps. You're a sports person. Are you into that?
Yes. Oh, yes. Olympics are great.
I kind of thought you might be into the Olympics. All right. 1942, Thailand declares war on the United States and England. And we were quivering in our boots, I'm sure. Thailand. What do you do in Thailand? 1945, Grand Rapids, Michigan becomes the first U.S. city to fluoridate its water.
Oh, really?
That was almost going to be my history highlight, the most important thing.
It's a good one.
Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Yeah. I didn't check into deep dive like why they made that call. In 1945 seems kind of early to me.
Yeah.
1949, the first Emmy Awards ceremony.
Okay, fun.
And we've had on the show Jeff Daly. I've actually held one of his Emmy Awards.
That for Where's Molly?
I don't know. No, actually, much earlier.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's got two or three of them.
That's great.
He brings around if you ask him to. He has a Mr. T doll.
Well, sure. Get an Emmy.
1971, Charles Manson and his followers are convicted of murder. 1979, and this is how long we've known, how long we should have been prepared for the robot uprising. 1979, the first documented case of a robot killing a human in the United States. Robert Williams was struck in the head and killed by the arm of a one-ton production line robot in the Ford Motor Company casting plant in Flat Rock, Michigan.
Ugh.
He's the first victim of the robot wars. I don't know when they're coming, but...
But they're coming.
But someday, the evil overlord robots will be here.
And then they said, that's why we're going to replace all you people.
That's right. And then the history highlight of the day, thing that had the most impact on history on this day, which is tomorrow, January 25th, 1961, President Kennedy holds the first live television news conference.
Oh.
It changes the whole presidential dynamics.
I like that. That is a good one.
I don't know what
first live.
Yeah, first live. Like I'm going to go before the cameras and start talking.
Sure.
Not just the fireside chats or anything like that, but actual, I'm going to come and talk.
Good. That's a good one for this week, too.
Yeah. What'd you find?
So 1972, Shirley Chisholm was the first African-American woman elected to U.S. Congress, and she announces her candidacy for president.
Wow.
Yeah. So of course I like
Which
that
year?
One.
Which year?
1972.
Way to go. Yep. Did she win?
She didn't make your list, and you know she would have made mine. So, so that was the only thing you missed.
Chisholm. I wonder if she's related to the Chisholm Trail. Of old lore.
Don't know. She didn't win the presidency, so we don't know more.
No, we don't know more. Okay, but she hasn't been forgotten by history because you just remembered her.
Yep.
So that's fantastic. Okay, so today, for no apparent reason, because it doesn't tie into any dates or anything like that, this has just been sitting in my list of potential topics, and today seemed like a good day.
Okay.
The Battle of Cape Lookout. So what does Scientology have to do with us here at the mouth of the Columbia River and the Oregon coast?
I have no idea.
Let's find out. L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, was smack dab in the middle of what might have been a dramatic encounter with Japanese submarines during World War II. Or maybe it was just a bunch of dramatic storytelling and a wee bit of fabrication or exaggeration by Hubbard. In either case, it's a fun story and we're going to share it today. We're not going to explore the entire military career of L. Ron Hubbard. His personal version is filled with many heroics and bravery, including being awarded the Purple Heart. But the official record would seem to dispel his version of his military exploits. No Purple Heart and very little heroics are in the official Navy record.
But most listeners will be familiar with the Japanese submarine shelling of Fort Stevens in June 1942. Our story takes place the following year, 1943. The PC-815 was a 173-foot steel-hulled subchaser constructed at the Albina Engine and Machinery Works in Portland, Oregon. She was originally equipped with two depth charge racks and two K-guns. The racks were used to roll depth charges off the ship's sterns, while the K-guns were used to catapult depth charges some distance away from the ship. Of course, the ship was also equipped with sonar system. Prior to taking command, Hubbard had finished a training course on the system at Key West, Florida. He did finish 20th in his class of 25. Oh, details.
He did graduate, though.
Yep.
So
okay.
I had a friend in high school. We had a class of 341, and he finished 340th. And I said, but hey, you still graduated. And he said, if I was going to be that low, I just wish I'd been the bottom.
Oh, yeah. The system would work in both active and passive modes, echo ranging with a series of pings or listening for noises made by propellers, motors, or other machines. PC-815 was commissioned in April 1943 with Lieutenant L. Ron Hubbard in command. A few weeks later, she sailed down the Columbia River to Astoria, Oregon, where she arrived on May 17 to take supplies. On May 18th, the PC-815 left Astoria for Bremerton, where she was to have radar and depth charge launchers fitted. Her journey was interrupted, however. Around 3:40 on the morning of May 19th, the crew detected what Hubbard thought was first one and then later two Imperial Japanese Navy submarines approximately 10 miles off the shore of Cape Lookout. I feel like we need music underneath.
We do kind of. We should have dramatic. Like, remember those old Victory at Sea films?
I can hear it. Both the sonar operator and Lieutenant Hubbard himself thought the echo of an active sonar ping, combined with apparent engine noises heard through the ship's hydrophone, indicated contact with a sub. According to the report he later submitted to the Navy, one of the objects veered away, so he followed and moved ahead of its trajectory. From his official report, in very un-Navy-like language,
the ship, sleepy and skeptical, had come to their guns swiftly and without error. No one, including the commanding officer, could readily credit the existence of an enemy submarine here on the steamer track, and all soundmen, now on the bridge, were attempting to argue the echo-ranging equipment and chemical recorder out of such fantastic ideas.
At 0450, a target on the surface was spotted, and Hubbard gave the order to open fire. His crew responded with
astonishing accuracy, bursts and shells converging on the target.
It turned out to be no more than a floating log, but Hubbard thought it was good for the morale of the gunners to ensure that the newly installed guns worked. It's not a bad point.
Actually, that is a good point, because, you know, if you can shoot the log or the whatever, yeah, then hey. You
and
can
they
shoot
worked.
Yeah, exactly.
The USS PC-815 mounted four further attacks on the elusive submarine in the hope of forcing it to surface without success. At the end of the sixth attack, the ship's supply of depth charges were exhausted. Urgent signals requesting more ammunition at first met with no response. At 0900, two U.S. Navy blimps, K-39 and K-33, appeared on the scene to help with the search.
And they would have come out of the Tillamook, the big giant hangar there.
Oh.
You know, there was the, I don't know if it still is or not, there's a Tillamook Air Museum. But there were two hangars there. One burned down, but the big giant hangar, if you've ever been in, it's just amazing. It's a wooden structure, but the two blimps would have come from there.
Wow. By noon, Hubbard believed that the submarine was disabled in some way, or at least unable to launch its torpedoes, since the PC-815, lying to in a smooth sea, presented an easy target and had not been attacked. In the early afternoon, a second subchaser, the USS SC-536, arrived, but it was unable to make contact with the target. On the bridge, Hubbard led the other ship on an attack run, blowing the whistle to signal when to drop its depth charges. The results were encouraging.
The observation blimps began to sight oil and air bubbles in the vicinity of the last attack, and finally a periscope. The ship also sighted air bubbles. At 1606, oil was reported again, and the ship saw oil. Great oil, air boils were seen, and the sound of blowing tanks was reported by the sound man. All guns were now manned with great attention, as it was supposed that the sub was trying to surface. Everyone was very calm, gunners joking about who would get in the first shot.
The PC-815 now made a startling discovery. There was not one submarine, but two. Dun, dun, dun. The second one was discovered some 420 yards away, drawing away at about 4 knots. At 1646, a Coast Guard patrol boat brought in further supplies of ammunition. 27 depth charges were transferred onto the USS PC-815 and made ready for firing. Not long afterwards, a second Coast Guard patrol boat, the Bonham, arrived, followed by another subchaser's, the USS SC-537. There was now a total of 5 ships and 2 observation blimps involved in the search. Not all of the ships seemed to be as keen as the PC-815, however, as Hubbard complained bitterly in his action report. A report that the submarine had surfaced caused the vessels to begin heading north, but they turned back after the submarine turned out to be a fishing boat.
Okay, I gotta say, how do you confuse a submarine with a fishing boat?
And how terrified would you be if you were on that boat?
oh, see this, all these ships conversing and blimps.
Headed towards you. Suddenly at 0700 on May 21st, 1943, he spotted the submarine attempting to surface.
Suddenly a boil of orange-colored oil, very thick, came to the surface immediately on our port bow. The commanding officer came forward on the double and saw a second boil of orange oil rising on the other side of the first. The sound man was loudly reporting that he heard tanks being blown on the port bow. Every man on the bridge and flying bridge then saw the periscope moving from right to left, rising up through the first oil boil to a height of about 2 feet. The barrel and lens of the instrument were unmistakable. On the appearance of the periscope, both gunners fired straight into the periscope, range about 50 yards. The periscope vanished in an explosion of 20 millimeter bullets.
A last attack run was executed by the PC-815 and SC-536, exhausting their last depth charges. As the ships continued to search for the elusive submarine, another sub-chaser, the PC-788, was sighted and cajoled into joining the search, although her captain
protested very strongly against helping, requesting continually to be allowed to be secured.
Frustratingly for Hubbard, even after the PC-815 and SC-536 had dropped around 100 depth charges, the sonar contact continued to be present but stationary on the sea bottom. At midnight, the PC-815 received orders to return to Astoria Naval Station, having been in action for some 68 hours. Hubbard noted that they were welcomed
with considerable skepticism. Her records had not been examined, her crew had not been questioned, and no qualified report had been made.
His ship had expended 37 depth charges and had maintained contact with submarines for more than 55 hours. Three minor casualties were suffered, probably as the result of being tired, affecting the crew's performance. Hubbard did not mention that he had nearly suffered a fatality. His executive officer, Thomas Moulton, was nearly shot when the starboard 20-millimeter gun accidentally fired off an entire magazine without anyone being at the trigger. The gun had been assembled incorrectly by an exhausted gunner and a key part put in backwards.
Okay, you can't make this up.
But that was actually documented somewhere, yes. Right?
Yes.
Moulton was on the mast of the PC-815 when the gun went off, firing until its entire ammunition drum was empty, missing him by a few inches and shooting off the ship's radio antenna. He later recalled,
I was making love to the mast and was almost out to the other side. Looking down the barrel, it looked like it was coming right toward me.
Finally, an honest sentence in there. In his 18-page after-action report, Hubbard claimed to have
definitely sunk beyond doubt
one submarine and critically damaged another. However, the subsequent investigation by Vice Admiral Frank Jack Fletcher cast a skeptical light on Hubbard's claims. His summary memorandum to the Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz stated,
an analysis of all reports convinces me that there was no submarine in the area. Lieutenant Commander Sullivan states that he was unable to obtain any evidence of a submarine except one bubble of air, which is unexplained, except by turbulence of water due to a depth charge explosion. The commanding officers of all ships, except the PC-815, state they have had no evidence of a submarine and do not think a submarine was in the area.
Fletcher added that
there is a known magnetic deposit in the area in which depth charges were dropped.
Absolving the responding blimps from any fault as their method of detecting submarines relies on a magnetic anomaly detector. This also implied that Lieutenant Hubbard and his crew were operating the ship's sonar equipment incorrectly.
Okay, so just like an amusing side note, because I was looking to see newspaper articles and other things connected to this story, and L. Ron Hubbard continued to claim for years that he'd sunk these two submarines, and I think to his death continued to claim this. But he also noted as part of his evidence that there was jagged metal from the exploded submarines, and it kept ripping Columbia River fishermen's nets.
Ooh.
When they were coming and going from the Columbia River, and that it was such a problem. All these nets were getting so ragged and ruined that at some point they hired an underwater demolition guy to finish destroying the metal.
Oh my goodness.
I could find no evidence of that in the newspapers either.
A month later, the PC-815 traveled to San Diego, her new home port. She arrived there on June 2nd and at the end of June was ordered to sea to join an anti-sub training exercise. The exercise, held in late June, ended early, and Hubbard took the opportunity to order an impromptu gunnery exercise while anchored just off the Mexican territory of South Coronado Island, just to the southwest of San Diego. He apparently did not realize the islands were, one, not abandoned, and also not part of the U.S. The Mexican Navy personnel on the island were surprised to be fired upon by the U.S. Navy. The Mexican government sent an official protest to the U.S. government as no gunnery operations had been scheduled. On June 30th, a board of investigation was convened concerning PC 815, which concluded that Hubbard had disregarded orders both by conducting gunnery practice and by anchoring in Mexican territorial waters without proper authority. His order stated that the PC 815 was supposed to return after completing the day's training. Hubbard argued that his crew was inexperienced. It was foggy, and he was so tired that he did not return to port as ordered. A month earlier, in his after-action report concerning the recent fiasco off Cape Lookout, he had described the same man as experienced and highly skilled. Vice Admiral Fletcher, who both chaired the board and read the prior after-action report, rated Hubbard, quote, below average, and noted,
consider this officer lacking in the essential qualities of judgment, leadership, and cooperation. He acts without forethought as to probable results. He is believed to have been sincere in his efforts to make the ship efficient and ready. Not considered qualified for command or promotion at this time. Recommend duty on a large vessel where he can be properly supervised.
Hubbard was relieved of command effective July 7th, 1943. After Hubbard was replaced, PC 815 remained in San Diego as a shore patrol vessel, but appears to have been mostly inactive during this period. According to her movement card, she took part in the occasional offshore patrol, training exercises, and escorting subs in and out of the harbor. She was restored to active duty on September 2, 1945, but on the morning of September 11th, the ship collided with the destroyer USS Laffey in dense fog off San Diego. The collision started a fire on board PC 815, which sank within 5 minutes. One man from PC 815 was recorded as missing, presumed drowned. The Laffey suffered significant damage with the fire from PC 815 spreading into one of the destroyer's compartments. Navy divers demolished the wreck in early November 1945 due to the navigation hazard that it posed to a busy shipping channel.
That's a fun story.
It is.
And, you know, it does, as an historian, it does kind of amaze me. Of course, we know about the Japanese submarine that threw shells at Fort Stevens and we didn't return fire. But it just seems odd that there really wasn't more on the West Coast, because it certainly drove us kind of panic mode.
Right.
And if they'd had more than just the one, maybe we would have been a little freaked out and pulled forces back, which is what the original idea had been.
Right, for sure.
But
I do find it interesting that one line in here, that in that after action report, the first sentence is, consider this officer lacking in essential qualities of judgment, leadership, and cooperation.
Yeah.
But man, he can pull a crowd together.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because they even said it in here too, that his entire ship stood by what he said. It was
They all agreed that they saw something.
Right.
And I also like the comment that his report was very, very narrative, very un-Navy-like, that he was quite the author.
Right. Which he stood by, right? Yeah. I mean, he's been very consistent.
Oh, yeah. There's tons of interviews and stories of him talking about this.
Yeah.
So. All right. Shall we take a little break?
Sounds good.
January 15th, 1884. Dinner at Jeff's Chop House every day from 4:30 to 8 o'clock. The best 25-cent meal in town. Soup, fish, 7 kinds of meats, vegetables, pies, pudding, etc. A glass of San Francisco beer, French claret, tea, or coffee included. All who have tried him say Jeff is the boss.
January 1926, you're invited in. The tempting baked goods in our show windows are only a promise of the big variety of delicious things inside. Here you will find a complete variety of baked goods, everything from tender, tempting bread to the fanciest of pastries. Individual attention given to special orders. Morrow's Bakery, phone 495.
And welcome back to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital. Good evening, Mac Burns. I'm glad to be here with you tonight.
So we've got, since we've got a little bit of time left, we got about 4 or 5 minutes. Shall we do a little local This Day in History?
Let's do it.
Let's see.
I start with today, this day in history.
Well, you can do that. Sure.
Today, January 24th. Perfect as a beverage or medicine is I.W. Harper whiskey, the kind your grandfather used, sold by Ford and Stokes Company, Astoria, Oregon.
That could be a commercial.
That's 1906.
Okay, yeah. I like January 25th, 1905. The Astoria Electric Company erected some time ago a modest but satisfactory waiting room at the eastern terminus of its streetcar line for the convenience of its patrons. Frequently, this place has been defiled in many ways, presumably by boys, and the company has been at considerable expense to repeatedly place it in repair again. The officers of the company have decided that it is the duty of those for whom it was erected to assist the company in punishing its desecrators, and if they do not do so, it'll be removed, and the former method of standing out in the rain to await a car will prevail.
And continuing in that same day, and obviously they couldn't just leave it to the one article, the police are now trying to discover the boys who persist in putting out the street arc lights, for much discomfort of the residents in the district where it happens. The way it is done is to pull down the rope holding the light a few feet and then let it go off, let go of it quickly. The result is the carbon is broken and the lamp is useless for the balance of the night. If residents of the city would assist the police in this matter, there would be no such complaint about the lights being out. Recently, a prominent citizen made such a complaint and was told that if he would ask his son about it, that the light on that particular corner would not go out again. No more complaints have come from that quarter.
Ooh, somebody calling out their kid.
Yep. And took care of it themselves.
I like that. Okay, so I know you don't think this is history because it's not long enough ago. January 25th, 2018. Public safety calls, suspicious circumstances, disturbances, neglected turtle. Woman believes her son-in-law is not caring for the family's turtle while his wife is in the hospital.
And I would believe that to be true, probably.
I just want to know if that was a 911 call or if that was like a regular phone call.
I think the local blotters love some of these calls, don't they? I don't know about the people answering the phone, though.
Yes.
January 26, 1925, balmy day sends many to bask at seashore. Beach parties in midwinter were a reality at Seaside. There hasn't been such a busy Sunday at the popular resort city since the close of last season. A continuous line of motor vehicle traffic plied between Astoria and Seaside yesterday, and there were hundreds of visitors from the city and over the county to the beach metropolis. The sun shone warmly. There was a total absence of wind. The sea was as smooth as glass, and the air was as mild as a temperance beverage. People strolled up and down the promenade or on the beach. Kids dug in the sand and skipped rope with long strands of kelp. Clamming parties were in evidence in the late afternoon, and some few parties even spread robes on the sand and basked in the warm sunshine.
Okay, now how that'd be reported today?
It didn't rain yesterday.
Seaside had many visitors and the weather was nice.
Yeah.
I just love the difference.
I do.
I mean, they were poetic in their reporting.
But you feel like you were there too when you read something like that, right?
I think for that one, the kids with the kelp.
Yes.
That's the one that just, I suddenly can really picture it. I mean, prior to that, I'm just picturing, oh, it was a beautiful day and there's the beach and the weather's nice and. But the kelp makes it kind of real. Oh,
we love those sunny days in January. We'll take more of them.
We will, definitely. And we'll take visitors, too.
There you go.
It would be nice to have visitors. I remember visitors.
Oh.
Once upon a time. But our gift shops are staying open no matter what. Every time we're closed, the gift shops are still staying open.
Because they're a gift store.
A gift store. And at least we can have a little income.
There we go. So stop by any of them.
All right. So you had Mac and Alana today on the best show ever. And thanks for living. Yes, thanks for living.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And go make some history. We'll catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.